Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, and today we're broadcasting from Roberta's in downtown Bushwick, Brooklyn, and it's a first day of spring in March, and my guest today, it's you know, like the sun's come out, the very handsome and wonderful Seamus Mullen.
Thank you.
And let me tell our audience, if they're not familiar, if they're not living in New York and realize that you've taken the New York Times by storm, not once, but three times for, three times for Suba Boqueria, and your really sensational restaurant, Tertulia. But Seamus has also been on The Next Iron Chef. He was the season two finalist. And he has, his work history is amazing. He worked for Mecca and Tabla in New York, and Crudo, he was the executive chef, but he's worked at the hallowed Mugaritz in Spain, Abac, Alchemia, you know, and it goes on and on. He has such a fascinating background, and we're going to get to it right now. But I also want to mention you're an author.
Yes,
you have
I am.
Hero Food. We'll get into that mm-hmm. later. So welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, like, you're one of the hottest Spanish chefs around, and you come from Vermont. We got to get into this.
Okay,
how does this happen? And a name like Seamus Mullen, I mean.
So, obviously, it's a very complicated story.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up on a small farm in Vermont. My parents were part of that kind of back to the earth movement in the 60s and 70s. And, very turbulent times in the United States. And they really wanted to. They were homesteaders in a lot of ways. You know, they wanted to live as far off the grid as they could and grow their own produce and raise their own animals. And my brother and I kind of grew up around that. Ironically, we both live in New York City now. But we still have very strong ties to country life.
Where in Vermont, if I can ask?
So I was born in what is known as the Northeast Kingdom, now mm-hmm. quite famous because of a bar here in Bushwick called the Northeast Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really one of the densest hardwood stands in all of the Eastern North America.
I didn't know
it's
that.
It's a really, really remote part of the world. Ooh, here comes coffee. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very remote part of the world. My folks moved there when they were in their early 20s, and they bought a plot of land. I think it was probably a mile and a half down from the end of a road. So you had to hike in to get to where the property was. And they built a yurt and they lived in the woods and had goats and cattle and pigs and chickens. And we lived there until I was about a year old. And then they decided, listen, this is a little bit too rural for raising children. So they moved to central Vermont, closer to what's called the Upper Valley, where Hanover, New Hampshire is, and Dartmouth College.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought about 80... It started as 80 acres. I think now we have about 120 acres.
Were they farmers? Were they subsistent? Did they live off the land when you
yes.
were in the yurt?
Yeah, they lived off the land. I mean, you know, my dad was had studied anthropology and was a musician, a classical musician, and he plays harpsichord and piano and things like that. But they,
did he have that in
oh
the
yeah
year?
Oh yeah, it was a very very esoteric upbringing of uh-huh. you know, a barn with a piano and a harpsichord and chickens and Scarlatti and all that stuff running around all together. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, was from England, is from England, and she had a very different upbringing, and she actually went to the Cordon Bleu in Paris in the 1930s, and she lived with my grandmother lived with the Sabatier family.
The knife family.
So we had a very long kind of on both my mother's and my father's side of the family, a very long relationship with food and with traditional classic cuisine. Mm. So even though we were raising our own stuff, I was always around very good cooking. Mm. And my mother and my grandmother sort of taught themselves. They actually taught themselves how to butcher from the Fanny Farmer cookbook. So we would raise pigs, and I remember as a kid having whole animals on the kitchen table, and my mom with butchering diagrams, and my grandmother holding the shoulders apart, and they were figuring out how to break down animals, and it wasn't long before my brother and I were obviously involved in that process. So we've been around, you know, what I like to call real food all our lives, my brother and I.
It's in your DNA.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So you grew up all K through 12 in Vermont?
Yeah, well, actually, I was in, so the town that I was in is a very small town called Verscher, and there was
Is that south of Burlington?
It is. It's about an hour south of Burlington. Mm-hmm. And in the late 60s, early 70s, a couple named Doris and Mac Connard started a school there called the Mountain School. Mm-hmm. And it was a private high school in a very rural part of Vermont. And in the 80s, Milton Academy bought it and turned it into an agricultural school that now has become quite famous. Alice Waters' daughter went there. Lots of very famous people have gone there. My good friend Jonathan Waxman, his daughter, is going there for a semester next year. It's a really amazing, it's a working farm and a high school. And so this is part of the reason why my parents moved to this town, a town of 300 people, but had a wonderful private high school. And then as my brother and I approached high school age, the school morphed into what it is today, which is a single semester school for high school juniors from all over the country. Mm-hmm. So we ended up not, going to the mountain school, but going to private school, going to a boarding school. And, the advantage of being in a small town with no high school was that the taxpayers' money went to paying for our tuition to go to any school we wanted to. So we ended up going to a very good private school.
Where'd you go?
I went to Northfield Mount Hermon. My brother and I both did. Mm-hmm. And that's where my whole love of Spanish kind of came into the picture. I was a pretty bad student. Unfortunately, I'm not very good at applying myself to things that I'm not into and not interested in, but the things that I do love, I really do apply myself. And I did very well in Spanish, and I had a wonderful Spanish teacher who suggested that I do a year abroad. So I did my senior year in Spain, mm-hmm. and that's really where things changed for me, and I started to, it opened my mind up to all sorts of things, not just the language and the culture, but obviously the food.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you were in Spain. What part of Spain?
The first time I went, I was 17 years old, and I was in Burgos, which is in Castilla León, in the north central part of Spain, about 2.5 hours north.
Is that
of
where they speak the best Spanish?
That's where they speak the true Castilian Spanish, mm-hmm. And it's where they have the best lamb in Spain. And it was just a really remarkable experience. I lived with a host family. I spoke very little Spanish when I got there, but I immediately started picking up the language and fell in love with the food and just really, it was an incredibly life-changing experience for me, and it really set the ball in motion for me to have this kind of lifelong love affair with Spain and with the food of Spain, and that was just the beginning. And then I ended up, of course, I've gone back many, many years over the years to live and work there.
So when you came back from Spain, you were still in high school.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So what was your head like then?
I was confused. I came back, and I basically came back, and I walked through graduation, and I got my high school diploma, and I went to college. I went to college for a year in Michigan, and then I did an independent study program in Costa Rica for 6 months.
Why Costa Rica? For surfing?
Well, my brother had just graduated from college, and he was in Costa Rica working for a newspaper. And
so he spoke Spanish too.
Yeah, he speaks Spanish, yes. And so he was like, "Listen, why don't you come down and spend some time with me down here?" And so I went down, and we had a great time, a tremendous time. We traveled all over Central America. And then I went back to Michigan for a quarter. We had a quarter system. and was really not feeling being in Michigan. And so I applied to an exchange program in Spain, and I immediately went back to Spain. So, and I finished out my college in Spain, 2 years there in southern Spain.
What was it about Spain?
I think it was just, for me, I grew up in such a really, really rural, remote, isolated area where my, you know, my sixth grade class had four students in it. I wasn't around, I didn't have peers. And when I first went to Spain, it just kind of opened my eyes up to a whole other world, and it was so exotic and exciting and different. And I just loved how different it was.
Do you think if you were sent to New York City, you would have had the same kind of experience?
I think I probably would have. I think that you know, I'm a very passionate person, and I think that what I found when I first went to Spain was this this real close connection to a culture, and it could have been any culture, but the fact that there was a very strong cultural identity in Spain, there was a real sense of place, there was a real pride about everything from food to architecture to history to art to literature. There was just this very, very strong sense of this is Spanish and this is ours and this is a reflection of who we are. And I think that's one of the things that's very hard for Americans, because we are such a young country in so many ways. And we're a country that I mean, this is a remarkable place. And I'm so happy to live in New York City, certainly more than anything because of the diversity of New York City. But the downside to the diversity when you're growing up in the United States is that there can sometimes be a lack of a single identity that I think as a kid is really helpful. Mm-hmm. Being able to really
relate to it
and say I'm a part of something, and I grew up also in very rural Vermont, where I was very different from the rest of the people I grew up from. You know, I my parents.
It's a rather conservative state for being liberal minded.
You would think that
they're Yankees.
Exactly, we're Yankees, and they're you know, it's down east. It's really like very, very old Vermont generations. It's very rural.
And they don't take to people from the outside very.
They call them flatlanders.
Yeah. So let me ask you something, because I've never actually met anyone who grew up, you know, with parents that went off the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, that was my generation.
Right.
And so, you know, I've done a lot of reflection mm-hmm. on it, that, you know, the organic movement, sustainability, carbon footprints, mm-hmm. that's what originally in the 1960s and early 70s, that's what
they were
off the grid.
It.
And they used to call them, they would wear earth shoes, and I did too. But, you know, organics, and it was all called crazy stuff back then. And people thought people were, and it's come full circle. So, how do your parents feel? I feel that they, you know, they were the leading edge. And how do your parents, do your parents live in a, how do they live today?
Well, my dad still drives workhorses and, you know, works on a farm. My mom still splits her own wood and, you know, raises her own produce. And I think that in so many ways, that generation was very much, they kind of set the tone for what our generation, particularly our generation of chefs, of cooks, how we think about product and we think about food and the relationship and provenance of food. I think they definitely set the tone for it. The difference was that the times were very, very different, as you know better than I do. It was really a polarized times. It was the end of the civil rights movement. It was the end of the Vietnam War. The Cold War was at its height. It was a very, very tense and complicated time when America was really divided and radicalized. And I think that part of my parents' generation, they really, it became very preaching to the choir. And it was sort of like, well, you know, we're all on board. And if you think about this whole notion of like communes, and they popped up all over the place. These communes are all about kind of, it's not very integrative. It's sort of exclusive. It's like, this is our little community and we're going to do it ourselves. Rather than, I feel like the movement today and how we've started to think about food, and now we're seeing, particularly in food, we're seeing kind of the long-term effects of industrial food. It's like, wait, this is a broader issue, and this is something that touches on everyone across the board, and it needs not to be as political as it was. when you the part of the problem with politicizing food too much is that you polarize people and you push people away. And I think that you know, our generation's job really is to just say, hey, you know what, there's something wrong with the way that we've eaten for a very long time, and I think my parents' generation was onto something about it, but we need to figure out how to communicate that to a greater public and make sure that the entirety of the country is on the same page, that we understand that food really food is not a product. Food is a part of our culture. And I think we lost our way at some point, and we're starting to find it now. And it's really wonderful to see that we're finding it now. But I think we're also seeing it now because we're in a crisis point, you know. And I really do truly believe that this morning I was just reading in the Times this morning as I was going through the Times, 1 in 50 children is born with autism now. And that to me just, I think of that and it's like, well, is this because we're better at diagnosing autism? Or is this because my generation is the first generation who has a full generation of industrial food consumption? Our parents, you know, my parents' generation didn't really start consuming modern foods until they were already past their formative years. They were already young adults. My generation, we were eating modern wheat. We were eating modern foods from the day we were born. So now the next generation, we're seeing all of these things like rises in autism, rises in autoimmune diseases. And I see this sort of the direction that we're going with food is not, we've got to kind of take the politics out of it, and we have to look about it as like, we've got a health crisis, and it affects every single human being on the planet.
Okay, well, we've got to take a break. Let's come back and continue that thread, because I think your book addresses that too, doesn't it?
It does,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be right back.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center. And today my guest is Seamus Mullen, who's the executive chef of Tortilla Restaurant in Greenwich Village. And we're just talking about his upbringing and really how close he was raised to the land, but that's not where a lot of our food comes from today, is
no,
it, Seamus?
No, unfortunately.
So, you know, how political do we have to make food today to get it right?
It's a really hard question because when we talk about politics and food, on a very literal level, obviously there are very powerful lobbyists that represent very powerful agribusiness. And in that sense, food is political. The decisions we've made about food in the past, and the development of industrial foods, had to do with exports of products from the United States. So that, in that sense, there are economic ramifications, and it's very political. However, I kind of like to take the politics and the preachiness out of it a bit, and just and get back to this notion of like of real food, which is
that's your book, Hero Food.
Hero right? Food is all about, and the subtitle of the book is how cooking with delicious things can make us feel better.
Why'd you call it Hero Food?
Well, I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease, and I'm pretty convinced that a part of why I have rheumatoid arthritis is because of the environment in which we live. There's a lot of things that are beyond our control in this country. We don't have strict labeling laws about genetically modified foods. As you know, my parents did a wonderful job when I was growing up to make sure that the food that my brother and I ate when we were at home growing up was food that we knew where it came from. We were aware of the
provenance.
Did
you have juvenile arthritis?
No, I didn't develop it until I was in my early 30s.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, where do you think the food impacted?
Well, it's hard for me to say how. I certainly can't say food caused that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at case after case of studies of control groups of whether it's Japanese American men and Japanese men living in Japan between the age ranges of 30 and 50, and you look at cancer rates between the two case studies, and you see that the cancer rates in the United States are far, far, far higher than they are in Japan. The same thing, but obviously there's a lot been written and studied about the women of Okinawa and the low rates of breast cancer in Okinawa. You have to think, I mean, to me, it just seems like it's too obvious a connection to draw to ignore that what we're consuming, or at the very least our environment that we're surrounding ourselves in, has an impact on whether disease thrives or disease doesn't thrive in our body.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, food can really be a hero. Food that the choices we make about the food that we eat.
Oh, so the hero food is about
it's
the
about
food
the food
being
itself.
Hero.
Foods are the heroes. The choices of the foods that we put into our body. You know, we all know the old adage, you are what you eat. Well, you really are what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
You eat crap, you're going to feel like crap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You eat good food, you're helping your body deal with the daily battle of fighting toxins.
So do you have a menu for arthritis?
Do I have a menu for arthritis?
Do you know?
Do I ever?
Because, okay. Well,
yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that I would say it really comes down to this notion of inflammation,
right?
And almost every medical issue has at its heart, on some level, the battle or the struggle with inflammation. Whether it's in the case of autism, whether it's inflammation at the neurological level, it's inflammation at the cellular level. If it is for me, inflammation in my joints and muscles, there are things that trigger inflammation, and there are things that help your immune system quell inflammation. And a lot of those things can be found in the foods that we eat.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, you know, as I was sort of discovering in the beginning of this journey for me, as I was diagnosed with RA and I started to think about foods and how they impacted the behavior of my disease, I realized through this incredible happy accident that so many of the things that I actually love to eat and that I love to cook with were actually the right things for me to be eating and cooking.
Oh, really? So, I'm very interested because my daughter has arthritis. So,
okay.
I've never sort of had a menu for her. So, mm-hmm. Tell us, for all us arthritis interested people,
sure.
what are the things that, what are good things and what are bad things? And I'm hero food, Seamus Mullen, if you're listening.
Yeah, go and check it out. So, I mean, here's sort of the basics, and I don't want to get into it too much, but basically, one, you want to make sure that you are balancing your immune system and you've got a healthy gut.
Mm-hmm.
So having a healthy gut means making sure that you've got good probiotics in your belly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So living foods are really good for that. Things
mm-hmm.
like kimchi,
mm-hmm.
Things like kefir. Those mm-hmm. are the getting good bacteria into your body that helps your body deal with.
So kimchi has bacteria?
Sure.
Because it's fermented?
Fermented, yeah. Fermented foods in general. If you look across the board, nearly every traditional culture has some sort of fermented food in their food culture.
So, yeah, what about yogurt? Because that puts itself out there as a heavy probiotic.
Yeah, and yogurt's great. I mean, that's what kefir is. You know, it really depends upon the yogurt, obviously. Sugar is kind of at the other end of the spectrum.
Really bad for you.
And sugar is horrible for you. And it doesn't matter if you're calling it high fructose corn syrup or if you're calling it, you know, honey. Anyway, I mean, honey's got some wonderful qualities to it as well.
Uh-huh.
But sugar in general tends to be, you know, whether you're looking in a lab at cancerous pathogens, they grow quickly with sugar. Whether you're talking about parasites, they feed off of sugar and they grow quickly. Sugar in general is a very pro-inflammatory ingredient. So when you're talking about yogurt, again, and this is a big part of my book, that provenance is really important. The choices you make about food, yogurt could be good for you or yogurt could be bad for you. And it just depends upon which yogurt you're choosing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're choosing a yogurt that's industrially made through super-duper ultra-pasteurized milk, that it comes from cows that have growth hormones, that have been fed antibiotics, and that yogurt is packed full of sugar, you're not doing yourself any justice.
Yuck.
You know, it's like the worst thing you're possibly doing.
Yeah.
But if you're actually, you know, if it's a yogurt that comes from naturally raised, from grass-fed milk, that unfortunately we, in most states, we do have to pasteurize our milk. Although I just got back from Pennsylvania over the weekend and I brought a whole bunch of unpasteurized raw milk, which is delicious. And it'll change how you think about milk. I mean, it's one of those amazing things that everybody should have the opportunity of tasting what real milk really tastes like.
Mm.
But if you have yogurt that comes from good grass-fed milk that has live cultures and doesn't have sugar in it, you're talking about something that's really good for your gut, that's good for your immune system, and that's a good starting place.
Mm.
So with anything, any kind of inflammation, and whether it is an osteoarthritis issue, in which there are other things that you can certainly do to help joint development and bone development, like making sure you have plenty of calcium and you have vitamin D and you've got lots of omega-3 fatty acids in your diet, whether they're coming from specific nuts or they're coming from anchovies or they're coming from almonds or flax seeds, those are all important things to have. But the base, sort of the starting ground for everything is really your gut, and it's your immune system. So the more you can do to help take care of that.
All right, so we got our guts under control.
You got to get your guts.
Get your hero food and get your guts.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Let's move on to a bit more savory things.
Yeah.
Tell me, what was it like working at Mugaritz? When did you work there?
I was in Mugaritz from 2003 to 2004.
Early days?
Yeah, it was an amazing. It was there before the fire. It's an incredible restaurant. Andoni is an amazing guy.
How'd you end up there?
I realized I was working in New York, and I knew I wanted to go to Europe, and I wanted to work in Europe, and I didn't speak French, ironically, at the time, even though Spain was starting to really explode as being the culinary destination in the world, it hadn't quite gotten there yet. And I knew about Mugaritz. I had read about it.
Tell our listeners what, you know, how iconic this restaurant is.
Mugaritz is Mugaritz, the word, is it's a Basque word, and it means this particular oak tree that was always planted at the corner of the intersection of two village properties. And where the restaurant is, if you've ever been there, you've been lost because it's almost impossible to find. It's about 25 minutes outside of San Sebastian, or half an hour outside of San Sebastian, up in the hills. And there was this wonderful oak tree, this Mugaritz, that was planted there, and that was the inspiration for the name. And Andoni Luis Aduriz is just this remarkable Basque chef who went through the traditional Spanish pathway. He worked at El Bulli in 1992, when there was weeks and weeks of three or four covers a day, and nobody was going there. And Ferran was very, just, he knew that they were onto something, and he refused to give up, and he kept pushing forward. And then Andoni worked for Martin Berasategui for a long time, and then left Martin to open Mugaritz, I think, in 99, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Late 90s, right around then. And he's just a remarkable guy that his food is very, I would say it's very inspired by the food of Michel Brault, and it's in that realm, and Michel Gérard from earlier on in the late 70s and early 80s. But he's really always stayed true to the flavors of the Basque region. And it's interesting to see his food how it's gone in these cycles where it's become sort of like extraterrestrial and really out there and wild and
give us an example
spiritual
of that.
And little things like we did one dish that was it was called pieza de vaca con lágrimas de pimientos asados, which means a piece of beef with tears of roasted vegetables. And that was when people were just starting to cook things at low temperature for long periods of time, and that was a beef cheek that was cooked for 72 hours. And then it was served in a consommé of roasted peppers. But to make this consommé, we'd grill like 1,000 peppers, and then they'd be charred, and then we'd put them into a bowl covered with a plastic wrap, and we'd steam them for like 20 minutes. And all of the steam, we would use it like a still, the same way you use a still to distill alcohol.
Wow.
The steam would rise up and we'd capture the steam, and that steam would then filter down into what became the consommé, the vegetable
wow.
tears. So it was like a very simple dish in so many ways. So there were two ingredients, but it was an extremely labor-intensive, long-time process to do it. And that was kind of like reflective dish in a lot of ways, in that the flavors of the Basque country of beef and of roasted peppers were there, but presented in a completely new way. A lot of wonderful techniques kind of evolved from where he's, I think, more than at a time when everybody was copying El Bulli, he worked very, very hard to not copy El Bulli, to do his own thing. And he always has, and in that sense, he's been a huge inspiration to so many people. And you know, his food is really remarkable. It's a beautiful setting. It's a beautiful, beautiful sort of spiritual experience to eat there. But it's very different from eating in New York City.
All right, so we're gonna take another break here, and when we come back, we're gonna talk about your cuisine and how you're, doing your thing in New York City.
Cool.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And my guest today is Seamus Mullen, the executive chef of Tertulia Restaurant in New York City. And we just came back from talking about Muritz.
You got Muritz, yep.
I'm trying to say it the Spanish way in Basque Country, where Seamus spent a lot of time in Spain, and his Spanish is beautiful. But now tell us about Tertulia. I mean, you have worked really in the Spanish vernacular a lot of your professional life.
Yeah, most of my professional life.
And we've spent a lot of time. Let's get right to the restaurant
sure.
today. Where has it all come together? What define your cuisine for me, Seamus Mullins' cuisine.
Well, one of the things that's really amazing about Tertulia is we have this. I should back up by saying what Tertulia is. Tertulia, the word tertulia, it's a wonderful, wonderful word in the Spanish language. And it's actually what we're having right now is a tertulia. A tertulia is when a group of people, usually it's more than two people, but a group of people sit together around a table and they have a wonderful conversation. It's kind of like a salon hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things that made me fall in love with Spain. the idea of what's called la sobremesa, which means you've finished lunch, because you don't really eat dinner in Spain. You eat lunch at 2 in the afternoon, and it ends at 6 in the evening. And you've finished lunch, and the crumbs have been swept off the table, and you've had your cup of coffee, and now you're having your cognac or your brandy, and everyone is talking. And there's six people around the table, and you're talking about football, you're talking about bird hunting, you're talking about politics, you're talking about art and literature, you're talking about whatever you want to be talking about, but that's the tertulia. And it's this wonderful kind of directed conversation that just evolves. And I love that moment after a meal when people are just, the food's the grease for the conversation, and the food is done, and now you're at the table, and you're just having, you know, you're really enjoying your company. So when I wanted to open this restaurant, I wanted the restaurant to really be about that. I wanted it to be about, you come together for the food, and I don't want to say you come with low expectations of the food, but you come because you want to be with your friends. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, as you're eating, the food just kind of starts to come, and you don't really order, and it just hits the table, and they're like these holy crap moments throughout the meal. You're like, wow, that tastes really good. That's amazing. I wasn't expecting that. Mm. And the food just becomes like a part of the whole experience. Mm. And that's what I always wanted tertulia to be. When I worked at Mugaritz on Mondays, which was our days off, or the restaurant was closed on Mondays, we would go as a group to these cider houses in the Basque Country, which are gigantic, very, very rustic, simple restaurants, where you order steak and it's cooked magnificently over wood fire coals, and you get tortilla de bacalao, salt cod tortilla, and you have glasses of cider and some meats and cheeses, and you get completely wasted, and you have just this wonderful time with great product but very simple meal. And I knew that in Asturias, just west of the Basque Country, they did it even better. That they really had the cider house down to a science. They call them chigres, or cidrería, where you have a glass of cider. So I started going to Asturias, and I found that they had these just amazing, this wonderful restaurants that are just convivial restaurants. You walk in, you leave your cares behind. Anything goes inside the cider house when you're there, and you just have a great time. And I wanted to take that and bring it to New York in some level. But I knew that it wouldn't really, you couldn't airlift that from Spain and drop it in New York. Just because it works there doesn't mean it's going to work here. And even a New Yorker who goes there and loves it when they're there, if you were to bring it here, they'd be like, oh, I don't like this. You know, it's too simple, or it's too whatever. It doesn't make sense. So like so many other things, we have to, in the way that Danielle and Jean-Georges have so brilliantly transformed French cuisine for New York, I wanted to, and not to compare myself to those guys because they're on a completely different level, but I wanted to take the essence of what they've done with French cuisine and presented it in a New York manner, with casual Spanish cuisine and presented it in a New York manner. Use the products that we have here. Use the ingredients that we have here. Follow the ethos that's so important to us about seasonal cooking and about cooking close to the source. But stay true to the flavor profiles,
an example of a dish. Describe a dish.
I call it cooking in the language of Spanish cuisine. Let me give you an example of a dish. Well, how could I? I mean, there's so many dishes that we could talk about. At the heart of our restaurant is this wood-fired grill that we took inspiration from the wood-fired grills of northern Spain, but then we built a custom grill that has just become this workhorse. And initially, we thought it would just be a place to grill fish and meat, and it would have a little more flavor because we're cooking over hardwood. But what we discovered is that it's really like a hearth. And in northern Spain, they cook in the hearth. Like, they'll make sausages and they'll hang them up in the hearth. And just all, you know, it's very damp there, so they really need the smoke.
So the hearth is like the dome over the fire.
It's more like a fireplace. Think of it as a fireplace.
All right.
It's just like an open fireplace that has kind of a Tuscan-style grill inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we discovered that in this box, this enclosure, this beautiful grill that we have, there are different temperature areas, different temperature zones. We could make a pot of beans and we could let it hang in there all day long, just under a small fire. And suddenly the beans would taste different just because they were being cooked over a little smoldering log instead of an electric hot plate or a gas burner.
Mm-hmm.
And smoke became this kind of ephemeral spice that you couldn't touch and you couldn't really see.
Mm-hmm.
You could sort of smell, but you could taste weaving through everything in our food. And in that essence, I think that that's where we've taken this notion of Northern Spanish cooking, and we've brought it into New York, and it courses through everything that we do. So you could have a beet salad in our restaurant a beet salad is probably one of the most ubiquitous things in any restaurant. It's probably the most boring salad you could ever want to have. But I guarantee you, when you have our beet salad, you won't think that way, because the beets are smoked, and there's raw beets, and there's pickled beets, and there's this smoky cheese in it. And suddenly it becomes like this exciting thing that you never expected. And would you ever have this dish in Spain? No.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they barely even eat vegetables, let alone beets.
But
there's something remarkably Spanish about it when you eat it in our restaurant, because of the wonderful Arbequina olive oil that we use, because of the excellent sherry vinegar that we use to pickle the vegetables, because of the Caña Rajal cheese that we drizzle over the top of it, because of the smoke that comes through. So in that sense, you could close your eyes and you eat it and you say, yeah, this dish has Spanish DNA. This is a Spanish dish. We're cooking in the Spanish vernacular. We just happen to be doing it in New York City and happen to be doing it our own way. So that's kind of what, in essence, kind of what Tertulia is. And it's been a real learning experience. We've learned that what we thought would be, as I said before, a simple grill for grilling a piece of fish has turned into being this just...
heartbeat.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is a heartbeat of the restaurant. And it's ever evolving, and we're learning new things every day. And our grill designer is a great guy, Ben Eisendrath from The Grillery. And this is the first installation he ever did in a restaurant. And he's worked with us to create all sorts of modifications to it. So we have shelving systems in the grill. You know, we grill
it. Is this the one that it goes up and down? I own one of those.
Oh, yeah, one of those.
Peter Kaminsky made me buy it.
Exactly. Yeah, well, Peter's a great guy, and Peter's in love with our grill. It does, but the thing that's remarkable about ours is it's built inside an enclosure. So all of that smoke stays within. And I've used... I've grilled on all sorts of wood-fired grills, and I've never grilled on one that has the same results as ours, just because of what happens within the grill. And we created hook systems and shelves, and you know, we have saute pans that I've drilled holes through to be able to saute vegetables with smoke. And
oh my,
we cook
gosh.
Our rice in there. I went bird
hunting. I know you're coming to the school.
We're going to talk all about rice.
Rice,
yeah, because rice is something that I feel very passionate about.
Tell me what you're going to tell the students.
Well, I really want to talk about the notion of paella, because paella, the word literally means pan. It comes mm-hmm. from an old Latin mm-hmm. word, padella, mm-hmm. for pan. And it's one of the most misunderstood dishes in the canon of Spanish cuisine, and often most misrepresented. And because of it, you know, sometimes I feel we cook a very traditional paella. We cook it over wood fire. It's a very, very thin paella. We don't put chorizo into our paella. We sort of follow the traditional rules. And of course, they're like, you know, everybody has their own rules about paella. But there are some people that still expect a gumbo style, risotto-y, big, gloppy mess of rice, thinking that that's what their paella should be, because that's what they've had in other restaurants here in the U.S. So we're going to talk a little bit about the essence of paella, but then we're also going to talk about different ways of cooking rice that could be perceived as paella, but may not be called paella. And it's a really interesting topic. It's something that I love cooking rice. I know a lot of cooks that shy away from it because they're scared of it, because it's a very hard thing to cook well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, is Seamus Mullen's cuisine always Spanish?
No.
Spanish-inflected.
It's funny that you ask this, because I just did... on Monday night, I just did a supper club at David Santos' restaurant, Loro. He asked me, he does a monthly supper club called Sagredo, where he asks a guest chef to come in, and you can cook whatever you want. And so I cooked Japanese food.
Really?
And more or less Japanese food, sort of Japanese.
DNA.
Exactly, seen through the lens of how we do it. So we did lots of raw fish dishes, but of course, like I love mackerel, so we cured our mackerel and we cold smoked it in the grill, and we branded it with a hot iron on the skin instead of using a blowtorch, and we served all sorts of different dishes that were all very, very inspired by the cuisine of Japan. But it was really wonderful for us to do. We did maybe 15 different dishes, that were all so dramatically different from what we typically cook every day. So is this all that I do Spanish cuisine? Not at all. This is what I've sort of become known for, and it's what I've focused on. But I just love good food. And, you know, I always tell the guys in the kitchen that good technique is good technique, and it doesn't matter what you're cooking. I mean, if you have solid technique, it's about the ingredients. And so you change the ingredients, maybe you learn a new technique, and you apply it. But as long as you have the fundamentals, you have good knife skills, you understand how to properly rest meat, you understand how to carve meat, you understand how to prepare vegetables properly, you understand the art of seasoning, all of those things are good technique. And if you have them, you can apply them to any cuisine.
Well, on that note, I think that's a great, that's a real great statement. I hope you make it to the students next Wednesday.
I will, definitely.
You got to know your trade.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
But, I mean, we're really lucky to have you in New York. Your restaurant is just terrific. I love the food there.
Thank you so much.
Everybody, you got to go there. And if you can't, get Hero Food. Thanks for coming today, Seamus.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Okay. It's been lovely talking with you.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll see you next time.
Sounds good.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.